Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
It just was a privilege to serve some of the people that I worked with, and the workforce in general there is amazing. They're dedicated. They care about each other. They care about the nation and the mission, and that's their focus. I mean, they're not there to get rich. I had so many people tell me I wasn't going to make it. Oh, you'll never graduate with an electrical engineering degree. You know, the girls just don't get through these classes, including a professor. So I was like, I'm just going to do this to prove them all wrong. Have you heard of misinformation? Have you heard of how they're influencing our democracy? I mean, what's happening here is you on an individual basis, you may think, I don't care. Do you know the depth of data that the analytics they can build on you?
After graduating from Georgia Tech with a degree in electrical engineering, Teresa Shea joined the National Security Agency, where she held several key leadership assignments during her 32-year career, culminating as the Director of Signals Intelligence. After NSA, Teresa joined InQtel, where she was Executive Vice President of Technology and Director of Cyber Reboot. Today, Teresa is Vice President of Cyber Offense and Defense Experts for Raytheon Intelligence and Space. Building on Raytheon's legacy of classified work with the United States government intelligence agencies and programs, Codex is focused on providing cyber capabilities for offense, defense, and security initiatives. Teresa Shea has received numerous awards during her career, including the President's Distinguished Rank Award from President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama, the National Intelligence Distinguished Service Medal, the Central Intelligence Agency's Donovan Award, and the Department of Defense Medal for Distinguished Civilian Service.
Well, I am here today with Teresa Shea, someone I sort of know, but very, very much admire. And I'm kind of geeking out internally and trying to be cool. Well, thank you so much. Now tell us where you are today.
Hey, Shayna. First of all, thank you. Thank you for having me on your distinguished podcast. I am so impressed with what you're doing in so many different ways, starting your own company, running a business, doing these podcasts, putting yourself out there. It's just awesome, awesome. And a model for the rest of us. Today, I am actually in Hilton Head at the beach. And so this just shows how much I care about you and what you're doing, that I came in off the beach just to do this.
Now, I want to ask you, because you must have so many demands asked of you all the time, how do you prioritize and set up your schedule to achieve what you need to achieve and enjoy your free time as well?
I have a couple of passions in my life that are priorities. One, as you probably would guess, would be our national security. I worry about that. I care about that. And I work hard at that every day because I do think we need to get into a better place. And most notably in cyber. Today, we live in a glass house, as we know, and we need to do more. The second is really my family, my grandchildren, which I am just blessed to have near me right now. So I spend a lot of my time with them. And we go on adventures and they bring so much joy to us. And we just take advantage of every moment we have with them. The third really is women and trying to promote, encourage women, especially in these cyber fields and engineering fields and, you know, math kind of STEM fields. And if you look at the impact of last year on women, this pandemic has impacted women more than I think we're aware of. Many of them have lost their support systems with schools closing and daycares closing.
And their parents being sick and their parents not being able to have access to them. Right. Exactly. I know a lot of people rely on their family and then they're not even able to see their family as well.
Yes, exactly. It's going to take us a long time to recover from that. And as women, we just need to help each other. We need to be aware and empathetic. And when these women are ready to come back to the workforce, open the door, help them get in.
Now, how many grandchildren do you have?
I have 4 grandchildren, 1 born during the pandemic.
Wow.
So that was their first, and that was tough for them. They live up in Massachusetts. And then my other 3 are actually local right now, but my son-in-law is in the Navy, so they move around a lot. And they're getting ready to move to California, and it's breaking my heart.
And what are the ages of your grandchildren?
Well, my oldest is 9, then 7. Those are both boys. Then I have a 4-year-old granddaughter who will be 5 this year. And then a brand new grandson who will be 1 year at the end of March.
How fun. And you have a boy and a girl, I'm guessing? Your children were a boy and a girl?
No, I have 2 daughters.
2 daughters.
In fact, my youngest, and this is really where I became most aware of what the pandemic was doing, started my awareness really. You know, she had to quit her job to be home with the baby. She didn't have much choice when COVID hit. Those 2 girls are the proudest thing I've ever done in my life. So I'm very proud of them.
That's awesome. Now, what do they do?
The oldest one is an electrical engineer. She's got her bachelor's and master's. And Shayna, she has started her own product company.
Oh, awesome.
The name of her company is actually called Simple File Upload. And I love the title of that because the key word there is simple. I think what she's trying to do with that product is make it simple. In fact, she started a podcast following in your footsteps, the Software Social Podcast. So she's got her own little thing going. And then my younger daughter is an environmental scientist.
And she's the one in Massachusetts?
She's the one in Massachusetts. That's right.
That's so cool that your daughters are off and thriving successfully, and mothers too. Now, describe for those who don't know you what your current position is.
So I am super excited to answer that question because I run this group called Cyber Offense and Defense Experts at Raytheon. And I've got this group of engineers, computer scientists, just these passionate individuals about the mission. I mean, they are so focused on serving the mission across the IC and in the DoD, which is our number one priority, moving that forward. And they're also brilliant. They're excited about what they do. Even with this pandemic and this real desire to do more work from home, they've had to come in because a lot of the work they do is classified and they have to be in SCIFs.
Sure.
And we've tried to, you know, accommodate that to make sure that we're doing everything right according to the CDC guidelines. But it's been tough on them, right?
Yeah.
What we're trying to do now, because these guys have for a long time, over a decade, been so good on the offensive mission. And my big thing is, let's take what we know from the offense and inform the defense. And you know, I had a long career at the National Security Agency. And this is really the advantage of having both those missions in one organization. You can inform each other.
Right.
And so it's just amazing to me to see these guys pivot to applying what they're doing offensively to improve our defense in terms of cybersecurity.
Now, for those who are not familiar with cybersecurity, can you describe what offense versus defense is and looks like?
So for example, you know, the SolarWinds attack, and it really does go back to intent, right? What was the intent of those attackers originally? Was it for intelligence purposes? Was it for to cause harm? And we have seen many of those advanced persistent threats, those adversary nation attacks that have caused tremendous amount of revenue damage across our country, stolen IP. You know, those kind of things we need to protect against. Our critical infrastructures, they're vulnerable to attacks. We don't want to be held ransom with being able to have power or being able to have water. So
right.
Building more basically zero trust resiliency into our networks and focusing first on those critical infrastructures and building out, that's really in the cybersecurity space. And then, you know, when I say offensive, that's really the computer network operations where we enable and build capabilities, trying to do more cutting edge technology, bringing in a lot of startup technology from some of these brilliant, fast-paced startups, and helping the IC and the DoD move forward in the offensive space. If you look at NSA's history, they have two missions, signals intelligence and information assurance. The information assurance is now called cybersecurity. And you saw about a year ago, they stood up a new directorate called the Cybersecurity Directorate. What we've seen is an evolution really caused by just this huge expansion of interconnectivity. Now we call it Internet of Things, this massive growth of data and the speed that 5G, 6G are going to bring to that. I mean, you know, we have seen cyber touch all aspects of our life. Is your refrigerator talking to you yet?
No, not mine.
I mean, that's where
and
we're going.
My husband won't let me watch like the cat videos either. He gets really mad when I bring them up. I was actually going to ask you if you have a smartphone and what kind of apps you have on your phone, right? Like, are you on Facebook? Are you on TikTok?
Anybody listening to this, if you're using TikTok, delete it from your app, your phone right now.
But why do we care if China has our information? Why do I care if perhaps Russia developed an app? Let's use the face aging app that was very popular for a while. Why do I care if Russia has a face aging app and has my information?
Have you heard of misinformation? Have you heard of how they're influencing our democracy? I mean, what's happening here is you on an individual basis, you may think, I don't care. Do you know the depth of data that the analytics they can build on you? Even Facebook today. Do you use Facebook, Shana?
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. And Google has like a whole map of your life, right?
Right.
From using Google Maps, they know where your office is. They know your pattern of life and they know exactly what you're doing and how you go about your day. So now they know what you look like. They know what you buy. They know who you talk to.
Google's a U.S. company.
Yes, Facebook.
we have laws and we have policies, but they're in a business. So they're creating analytics to serve you up ads. But let's go back to those advanced persistent threats, those nation state adversaries.
Right.
They don't follow any rules. They don't have any boundaries. You have no idea what they're doing with your data. Trust me, they're creating such a large, massive amount of data that they're then developing analytics against, think AI, machine learning, that they are using to advance their, and it goes back to intent, but their intent is they want to be the number one and they want to control the rest of us. That's why I wake up every day and say, we're going to improve our national security today.
Right. Can you explain what zero trust is and what that means from a cyber evolution?
The easy part about that is exactly what it says, zero trust. That means I don't trust anybody. I don't trust any device. I am constantly validating and verifying what's on my network. I know my network better than anybody else. That's situational awareness. That is 24/7 constant. We've been saying for a long, long, long time that you have bad actors in your network. You just don't know it. And if you haven't been hacked yet, well, never say never. The other part of that is sort of this cyber resiliency. I'm a proponent of constant defense. I don't believe we're going to get to 100% secure networks anytime soon. I am a believer in you just constantly have to defend, build in resiliency. When you have to take a particular part of your network down, build in a resiliency so that you can bring it back up or you can bring back portions of it or you have some ability to do that. Really, it's about focus on the cyber resiliency with the goal of getting to the zero trust model.
It's interesting as a small business, Nyla started in 2013. We've never owned our own server. We've never owned our own network, even if you count, you could count the router in my house, right? So I started the business from my house and all of the software that we use to run our business is software as a service. Even Microsoft you used to buy the disk and install the disk with that huge code. And now even Microsoft, you have to pay for a subscription. It automatically syncs to let you know you're out of date. But all of the software that we use to run our business enterprise, we access across the internet, the proper internet. And so we have to, one, ensure that only valid company employees are accessing them and that the software we're accessing is the actual software we expect and that there's no leaks from that as well. So it's a zero trust environment too. And also to assume that those pieces of software may have faults as well. And how do we handle that? For example, there are ransomware attacks on Microsoft. A lot of people have a lot of their company intellectual property on Google Drive or Microsoft, and a hacker can get in, encrypt your entire file system, and then they ask for money to get it back. And that's a huge, massive impact to a small business.
Oh, yeah. Even on the individual basis. My father is 87 years old, and I'm constantly reminding him, don't click on that link, you know, because we each have to take some responsibility, some personal responsibility for protecting our own activities online. Your description of exactly how your business runs is the norm today, and I'm all for it, because then you have the bigger corporations, if you will, building in that security, right, and adding that security in a much faster pace than you could do on a small business level.
We actually would have to go out of our way to build our own servers and have our own network and connect to our network. We would literally, none of the software that we need to use to run is meant to be in a standalone environment. We would very specifically have to look for that and make reasons, and then you're potentially out of sync as well. And then you're tracking your own network pretty intensely. When you were a little girl, what did you want to grow up and be? Did you envision this cybersecurity that someday you would be a grandmother talking about national security from a cyber perspective?
Yeah, no, I was never had that kind of foresight. I am so impressed with the girls in high school and today. I mean, they're so much further advanced than I ever was. And, you know, that was a long, long time ago. But, you know, I grew up in Georgia, in Mableton, Georgia. We were a poor family. And my big thing was I wanted to be a math teacher because I loved math. And when I was in high school, this organization called the Society of Women Engineers gave me a little scholarship. And I had never heard of them. Back in those days, we'd have encyclopedias, the books, going to the ebook, looking up engineer, actually reading what they did and thought, huh, that's intriguing. Well, Georgia Tech was 17 miles from my house. I ended up transferring over to Georgia Tech, largely because math teachers weren't paid anything at the time in Georgia, and I wanted to make more money. And so I thought, I can do this.
What year did you transfer?
This would have been 1978.
Were you going to community college or a local college first?
No. I was at, Georgia Southern in Statesboro, Georgia is probably one of the best teaching colleges.
What did your parents do for a living?
So my mom went back to college when I was in high school.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, there were five of us. So there were five kids in this family. And my father was a traveling salesman.
What'd he sell?
So he sold insurance. So she was very busy, but she was always a proponent of education and a huge supporter. There were three girls, two boys, huge supporter of all of us, including, you know, the girls having a career. And so she went back to get her nursing, her registered nursing degree when I was in high school. I can remember thinking, wow. Because that wasn't an easy thing to do back in those days, right?
Right. And did you have to make dinner then? Like, who was in charge of making dinner?
Being the oldest girl, yeah, there was a lot of that responsibility. She ended up being an administrator at a nursing home.
She went to work full time. She got her nursing degree at night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then she went to work full time.
Yep.
So she still had kids in middle school and high school when this is happening.
That's right.
Was there an expectation that you were going to go to college? Were all five of you expected to go to college?
There definitely was an expectation. Now, there wasn't the money, so we were all trying to figure that out on our own. You know, kind of figure that out. But in-state school at that time was affordable compared to now.
You're the oldest of five?
Oldest girl. I have one older brother.
So your brother goes off to college. What does he do?
He became a policeman and then, a detective. It's great now because he does some of those true detective shows and it's great to watch him on there.
How so cool.
Yeah.
You're in high school when the Society of Women Engineers gives you the scholarship?
Yeah. Boy, okay. That influenced my life a lot.
Now, did anyone come down and talk to you or they just like hand you money? Was there like follow-up or mentorship from it?
No, in high school, you have the end of the year awards. I had no idea. And, I think it was a $50 award. I don't, it was something really.
Well, apparently it was high ROI.
Right.
I mean, look at you now. They were like, that's the best $50. My God, I'm going to go give to the Society of Women Engineers after this. Holy hell, what a story, Teresa.
Yeah, and so today, for example, I'm on the Georgia Tech Advisory Board because I ended up going there to get my undergraduate degree. And I love the fact that they're still an active society and they still contribute to women who desire to be engineers today. And so...
Well, thank God for them because there's still so few, especially in electrical engineering and especially in computer science, which are often two of the biggest leaders into cybersecurity work. You were at teaching college, deciding to be a math teacher, and somehow you decide that the pay is not going to be good enough for what you want for your life. Where did this come from? Like, where did this desire for like, I think I should make more money hit your brain? And then like, your memory of encyclopedia. Like, did you even know engineers growing up? Did you know any engineers?
My uncle in California was an engineer. Actually, he was an electrical engineer and he worked on the NASA space station.
Oh, wow. And, that's super cool.
And he was super supportive as well. He would tell me stories about how he designed the toilet on the first space station.
It had to close. That thing had to close tightly, right?
So it just really made me appreciate the breadth of options in the engineering field. I mean, you could do all kinds of things that I never would have imagined.
But who else is talking to you at this teacher college that like maybe you should transfer? Like, how did that even come about?
So my calculus teacher there, and I still remember him because he was awesome. So this would have been the first calculus.
Okay. So right away.
They didn't teach it in my high school. So I had to take it in college. But he was awesome just with his encouragement and support. And, he didn't try and push me into anything, but he was the one that suggested, hey, have you all thought about how much money you're going to make as a math teacher versus perhaps as an engineer? And I remember looking into it, asking around, talking to people.
Where'd you get the data from?
There was not an internet. It wasn't like I couldn't Google it or anything like that at the time.
Did you call like the Society of Women Engineer phone number?
No, I talked to some teachers and asked my Uncle Jack about engineer salary. I remembered having that conversation with him, which was really a unique experience because he was very transparent with me and very encouraging. I give a lot of credit to those that, it's kind of a circle, right? People help you and you help others.
This podcast is sponsored by Nyla Technology Solutions, an SBA certified 8A HubZone, woman-owned small business specializing in full-stack software engineering and data science services to the U.S. government. Our innovative solutions are built to match the speed of mission. For more information, partnering opportunities, and new job openings, please visit our website, www.nyla.io.
Did you always think like that you wanted to work for a living? Because wasn't that kind of against the culture of most people at the time? Most women were raised to get married and then expect to stay home after they had children.
You hit the nail on the head, but I had no interest in that.
No?
None.
Were you like, five kids was enough?
I was like, I'm working. I love working. I worked from the time I was 13 years old.
What'd you, do?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what I did.
Did you babysit?
When I babysat, when I swept driveways,
yeah.
I delivered papers, you know, whatever it was I could do.
So you worked a bunch of jobs. Did you have to work to pay yourself through college too?
Yeah, and I borrowed money. I took out a loan as well.
What was your Georgia Tech experience like? I mean, not only is it an engineering school, but now you're switching from, I'm guessing, small town Georgia to the city of Atlanta.
Yeah. At first I lived at home because remember, 17 miles away. And then that just wasn't working. I was trying to do too much. I did move down into the dorms, but there's a couple of things first. And this is the thing I always tell girls. Hey, there's a lot more men in engineering. I met my husband there, and trust me, I had my pick. So, you know, my daughter, my oldest daughter, who's an engineer, she went to Purdue and she met her husband there. I mean,
I do find female engineers are locked down with somebody quick. It's like there are so few female engineers that the men are like, I want a girlfriend. You're going to be my girlfriend. Please stay and be my girlfriend. So typically I find like most female engineers are always paired up quickly. And I think the engineers tend to be very like committed boyfriends. They're not like running around because they got a whole bunch of work to do as well. Everybody's got like a ton of problem sets. They're not running around at like some big frat party.
The other thing I wanted to mention that people probably don't know that really had a big impact on me in terms of teaching me at the time confidence and how to really trust yourself and believe in yourself and know that you'll figure it out. Georgia Tech had a class called Drown Proofing. Now, they don't have that class anymore, but at the time, in order to graduate from Georgia Tech, you had to take this class. And they did things in this class like tie your hands behind your back, tie your feet together, and you had to make your way across the entire length of the pool with the deep end. So you go through the deep end, come back out and figure out how to do that. They put weights
it's like
around
Navy
your neck.
Training.
It's like Navy training because the roots of Georgia Tech is a Navy school, but everybody had to take it.
That's wild.
What they did was you had a partner. So your partner was supposed to save you if you were drowning because they were supposed to watch you when you were in the water and then you were supposed to watch them. Well, I was a big girl. And my partner, the only other girl in the class, was this tiny little. And I was thinking to myself, there is no way this tiny girl can get me off.
You're like, no matter how hard this chick tries, she is never going to save me. And there was no backup to the backup, right? Like
there was no backup to the backup, at least that I could tell. There was one point when I was in the deep end, my hands were tied behind my back and I had a weight on. And I was seriously thinking, I'm going to die, right? I remember that moment. And what happened was I sunk down to the bottom of the pool, right? You do that, right? When your air leaves your lungs, you sink. And my feet touched the bottom. And it occurred to me that I could do the bobbing thing to get out of the deep end. And that worked. I was like, wow, if I can figure that out, I can do this engineering stuff.
Was that the beginning of your Georgia Tech experience or at the end?
That was more at the beginning. You got to remember a lot of the girls were dropping out. So of the three girls that I started electrical engineering with, I was the only one that stayed with electrical engineering. The other two transferred to industrial engineering.
So what made you decide to stick with it? Why did you lean into electrical and not quit?
I had so many people tell me I wasn't going to make it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you'll never graduate with an electrical engineering degree. You know, the girls just don't get through these classes, including a professor. So I was like, I'm just going to do this to prove them all wrong.
Yeah.
And then, Shayna, as you know, end of my junior year, beginning of my senior year, I met my husband. You know, he was a huge and to this day and through my entire career, just a big supporter. I mean, you know,
is he an electrical engineer too?
He is.
Was he in the same grade class? Were you in class together?
We were not in class together because he was one semester ahead of me. But I ended up marrying him in, like I said, 30.
How old were you when you got married?
He was 21. I was 22.
Oh, my gosh. And did you get married on campus?
No, no. When he graduated, he went to University of Illinois to get his master's. And so I went out there and actually took a job with Decatur, Illinois Power Company and started out as a power engineer. And I lived in Decatur and he lived in Champaign, Urbana. And then he proposed about 6 months later and we got married that summer. So we got married when he was in graduate school.
Were you compelled to get your master's right away as well?
No, because 11 months later, after we got married, we had our first child.
Wow. Wow. What was childcare like at the time? Like, were you working? What was the situation?
So he graduated and took a job with the National Security Agency. So we moved to Maryland. I didn't work.
So they recruited him?
They recruited him. His roommate from Georgia Tech worked there.
Okay.
So he was instrumental in recruiting him as well.
Was this in Maryland at the time? Or was it?
Yeah. At Fort Meade. Yeah. Right there at Fort Meade. So I didn't work for, about 6 months. And then I decided I wanted to go back to work. And I went back January 1984. And I just immediately, the mission just got in my blood. I mean, I just loved it. Childcare was a constant challenge.
Did it always fall to you to take care of the childcare? Or how was the marital duty split?
You can ask me and then ask him because we have different opinions.
Well, there is always three opinions on one story.
Look, so one of the things I think women bring to the table and all that they do is an emotional intelligence that is unique and incredibly valuable. And we just have this sense of nurturing and empathy. And quite frankly, I wouldn't trust him to take care of childcare. No offense. I mean, I wanted to make those decisions and kind of be on point for that. So
okay.
I sort of stepped into that space. But, he was always supportive and good about trying to share cooking and things like that.
So were you able to work full time at this time? Were you working a true 40-hour week?
Yep.
And what did you have to wear to work? Did they have a uniform? Tell me all about that.
Those were the days where you'd go into the shop at work and the guys would have girly pictures on the wall, right? Girly calendars. You remember those? Do you remember? No, those were probably before your time. It was a different time in a different culture.
I know, but did you have to wear pantyhose? Like, were you allowed to wear pants?
There were some things you could not do, but I think we always tried to be professional. I think how you look matters, whether we like it or not. It's a fact. And we certainly have gotten, I don't think I've been in a pair of pants since COVID started. I mean, we'll see how this impacts the dress code.
So you fully leaned into like leggings and joggers?
Now I am. Yeah, not then. No. Back then, you wore pantsuits. And
so did you always wear a suit to work?
I didn't always wear a suit, but definitely was professional attire. And I think people took me more seriously when I was dressed more professionally, as bad as that may sound, saying it out loud.
There's actual studies that show that the act of putting on a uniform, so a doctor has a higher degree of accuracy in diagnoses when they put on their coat versus not have their coat on. So there may be, I think it might be dissipating quite a bit because it seems like at the agency, which I guess was progressive, that they didn't have a dress code. And now it's really like, there's like no holds barred. People dress now, like there really is like, I have seen all the things. But there has been studies that show that the act of putting on a uniform, so whether it is your personal uniform, right, whether it's been a subscribed uniform or your personal uniform, sets you up for thinking that you're now about to do this series of work. I felt sometimes because I'm very girly that my appearance, which was very feminine, dresses, jewelry, hurt me because I didn't dress more like the men, that I wasn't into wearing a polo or jeans and tennis shoes, right? That I would show up in a full you know, all dressed up. Like, I'm into fashion. I wanted to wear cute things. And I felt that that actually hurt me professionally. Maybe I should have, like, focused on a more black uniform. Like, I don't know.
Good for you for being you, right? We need to be.
But I always
and look at you now. You have your own business. You're successful.
Yeah, well, I was going to stay in at all costs, right? Like, I didn't care what people said or that they didn't think I was an engineer based on my appearance, but I was too stubborn to leave. So what was your career like at the agency?
Look, I was there for 34 years and it just was a privilege to serve some of the people that I worked with, and the workforce in general there is amazing. You know, they're dedicated. They care. They care about each other. They care about the nation and the mission. And that's their focus. I mean, they're not there to get rich.
The Senate has now confirmed Chris Inglis to be the president's national cyber director. So that's very exciting news. And we should all be really pleased with that. And Jenny Easterly was just confirmed this week to serve as the CISA director in the Department of Homeland Security, another great operator that has, you know, great experience, and she's going to really make a difference for us in this cybersecurity critical infrastructure space, I think, leading that organization at DHS. And then, you know, Anne Neuberger, she's the new deputy national security advisor, hit the ground running, doing really awesome work in pushing forward some very much needed policies and procedures. And so I think that's going to be a great team at the very high level across the government.
What is it about Chris? I have only heard the most rave reviews about Chris. Consistently, he is considered one of the most amazing technical leaders. What is it that you think that makes him so extraordinary?
He's very humble. You know, he gives credit to others. He assumes noble intent. He synthesizes information in real time very well. He's one of the best I've seen do that. He's always a step ahead in his thinking. His interpersonal skills combined with his technical understanding and awareness just make him, you know, we're lucky. We are very blessed to have him as a national asset, in my opinion.
Now, can you describe the difference between NSA's role in cybersecurity and the Department of Homeland Security, which is still a new agency at, what is it, 10, 11 years old now? No, longer than that, 20 years.
Let's see. It happened right after 9/11, 2001. So what, it was established in 2002.
Wow.
So yeah. So I think you're right.
It's not a baby agency anymore. So
yeah. Now CISA's pretty new, right? I mean, I think CISA was stood up when Suzanne Spaulding was there. So I think that's relatively new, as you know, they combined a couple of different organizations to create CISA. So NSA's cyber focus is really largely about DOD, new authorities on the DIB. So they're really concerned and focused on Department of Defense and Defense Industrial Base. CISA, you can think of them as .gov and private sector. So they have all the critical infrastructures.
Why do you think women should be encouraged to go into this? Why do you think the diversity is important?
Because of the creativity they bring, right? They think differently. You know, everybody has a different experience from where they sit. One of the things that I hope we've learned by now is we don't want to fall into the trap of groupthink. And when 9/11 happened, the intelligence community, NSA, we were devastated because we viewed that as a failure on our part. One of the things was, we didn't imagine that that kind of attack could happen, for example. And so how do you get to a place where you have these imaginations from all these different experiences so that when you bring them together, you have a whole different view on not only ideas and innovation, but outcomes?
I think it's also important to create an environment where not only are they in the door, but they are allowed to speak up. When I went to college, we had to study a book before we arrived where we studied the Tacoma Narrows bridge disaster, this bridge that ended up oscillating at the same frequency of the wind and crashing and killing everyone who was on it at the time. And then the O-ring disaster that caused the space shuttle to explode. And a lot of times people know, they're aware of the risk. And in fact, with the O-ring disaster, they were on conference calls the entire day to talk about it. So it's not just the difference of thought, but the allowance for that person to feel psychologically safe, to speak up, to speak truth to power. At my company, I try to be very cognizant. I always say, like, tell me it. I might not like it when you tell me it, right? Like, I'm going to be honest. I might wince. I might have to, like, and I'm not going to have a perfect game face, but I will listen, right? I want you to feel comfortable bringing up these painful truths that people need to know, because it could be something as significant of, we have this really significant repeated pattern that is causing something. You know, Joe knew this whole time that this failure was about to occur, but there was an environment or a culture where no one was allowed to speak up, and people can't speak up because they're afraid of their jobs, or they bring it up and then they're essentially blacklisted from opportunities and jobs. What advice do you have for people who are looking to be promoted or going up to a next level? What is your typical advice for someone who wants to be a senior, a leader, an executive in a technical organization?
Results matter. The model we used at NSA is called the STAR model. Have you heard of it?
No.
It's a situation, task, action, and result. Because sometimes things that you're trying to achieve, the result you're trying to achieve, you don't have control over all pieces and parts of that. That's normally true because functions usually lay outside of your span of control. So the situation matters. The tasks that you need to accomplish matters, and the actions you took and how you went about taking them. Behavior is critically important. Behave in the way you want others to emulate. You want to create that culture that thrives in that kind of environment.
How did you figure out how to lead a team and how to make a team effective? So as you move up, it's moving from individual effectiveness and results to working across groups of people to get the results. What do you think is the secret to really making an effective team?
Early on, when I was first coming out of being the technical contributor to more of a leader of a team, I was so frustrated that I couldn't help. I didn't know how to solve the tough technical problem. I remember being in a lab one time with my team, and I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't help them solve this really tough challenge that they had in front of them. And the floor in the lab was dirty. So I got the broom and swept the floor. And that was my contribution. And you know, the team, the people on the team talked about that for months afterwards, how the boss was sweeping the floor. And that's not really her job. You got to be willing to do the hard, you know, the things that maybe are harder or seen as less
desirable. Yeah.
Yeah. Be willing to do those things that you ask others, that you're going to ask others to do. If you're going to ask somebody to sweep the floor, be willing to do that yourself and do it on occasion. Just demonstrate your, I think as the teams got larger and the organizations got larger, trust is a huge, huge foundational requirement for any team. Building that trust, and trust is, in business, and I am talking about in business, is built on competence and communication. So I always tried to run the Signals Intelligence Directorate with delegating authority as much as I can and running in that. I had two deputies and being partners with my deputies. So they had transparency into what I was doing and vice versa, and we could cover for each other. And that brought a lot of confidence to them. And when things got tough, you know, and they did get tough, we were there for each other.
and very supportive and built long-lasting relationships from those kinds of times. Trying times do build good relationships, but trust is number one on my list with your team, with your senior leaders, knowing that they're going to do the right thing and you don't have to constantly be looking at it or micromanaging it, or, you know, you can rely on them.
Did you struggle with being a working mom and figuring out how to be there for your daughters? And were you worried that as you took greater leadership positions that you would be less of a mother?
Always. Always worried about that. Do you believe in this work-life balance?
No. No. But I think, you know, my mother, I was the youngest, and my mother didn't start working as a nurse until I was in first grade. So when I went to first grade, she started working, and she started working part-time. And then I would go over to the neighbors in the morning and early because she had to go to work. They had these very clear shifts. So she would drop me off at the neighbors. And sometimes I was watched by another person in the neighborhood. And then I don't know if it's a blessing. I mean, it seems weird to say, but there are beautiful things that come out sometimes from people's pain that they have in their life. And so my mother died when I was 30 before I had my own children.
Oh.
And a lot of her values were imprinted on me. But the number one thing was my mother loved me. And she was not there for all the things. Also, because I was the third daughter. And she's like, I am not sitting through every piano practice. Like, that's ridiculous, Shayna. I am not attending, you know, all of these things and just sitting through it all. But there was never, ever, ever a question that she loved me. And also, I really liked the alone time. Like, if she was there, I was having to do dishes or, like, I don't know. But I liked getting the time. And my sisters and I, we watched Oprah in the afternoon. It was like the time of soap operas and Oprah and just laying around that, you know, that early 80s, like laying around, and we would scramble to complete our chores as she was pulling into the house. And I think I've been blessed with not feeling guilt about being a working mother. And the blessing of being able to work from home is my kids can wake up and they found me, and you know, they're tired and they just want to be touching you. And so I can be working on an email and they still feel the care. It's not really any different than if I was reading a book right next to them and holding them or cuddling them. So I've been blessed to not feel that guilt. But I've also had women like you before me to set this example. So I think I knew of you, and just this, that's another reason for the podcast, is because just you being you, you don't even have to do the one-on-one stories or have a lunch with someone or a coffee with someone. The act of you being you and living how you lived has an impression on me. And I think that the freedom to go up at that level, right? Or to be at that level and to be a married woman, to enjoy your marriage and to enjoy your children and to enjoy your work. And I think that, you know, that is the having it all, to like love what you do and to have grown and to thrive and then to see your own children thriving. And I just think that that's a big element of it. And you probably didn't, like, I think women whose mothers stayed at home, they struggle with that more, right? Because you didn't have that modeled. And then not necessarily did you have other working women leaning into being an executive. So people work, but it was a, I feel like the culture at the time, and tell me if I'm wrong, but was like, if you become senior, you hurt your marriage potentially because you are leaning in and you're more powerful than your husband. So it's not even the dollar amount, right? It's like the respect and the earning. And if your husband isn't at the equal level, then he might be uncomfortable with that, or you're not paying him enough attention. And then you might not have friends because no one likes you, because you're, it's like, it's lonely at the top. Did you have all of those feelings, and what did you do about it?
Well, first, can I say thank you? That was so eloquent. Thank you for sharing that. That was so well said. Yes, I did have all those feelings, and that was part of the culture at the time. And I think your point about guilt, and this is funny because I said this to my son-in-law
I remember when your children grow up, Shana, and they get married, they bring somebody else into the family unit that didn't grow up in your family. So they're like shocked at what you your different things you do as a family. And I remember saying to my son-in-law one time, you just shed that guilt. Guilt will, it's not going to do you any good. Just shed
it. Just like panicking.
You're going to always be pulled in multiple directions. It's about your priorities, right? So just focus on your priorities, make those decisions, move forward, and don't beat yourself up about it. And I really do think my husband helped me really live that versus kind of just saying it, because it is different living it than it is just saying it.
What was so appealing about the agency that you stayed for so many years?
The mission and the people. We were in the last 20 years, we were in a war. We were saving lives with intelligence. And I didn't want to miss a beat in that. And that was so rewarding and so purposeful. When you leave DOD and the IC, you get a lot of mementos and awards and a lot of that kind of stuff. But the one thing that I keep on my desk is a letter from one of the soldiers where we saved his platoon in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Timely and actionable intelligence. And that's what it's all about. And the people cared, this is despite the bad rap sometimes NSA gets, they are the most hardworking and most passionate, smartest people there are. And we're lucky and blessed in this country to have them dedicated.
Maybe it's unfair comparison because I haven't worked in commercial industry for very long in my career, but I find that there are a lot of technical women and the government does a lot to include diversity, even though they have far to go. They probably are much better than commercial industry. What do you think it is that is compelling for women and people of color to work in that space?
Well, I hope that they recognize the opportunity. Those kinds of organizations are worldwide organizations. So, for example, I did 2.5 years in London. And I got to live in downtown London and work in downtown London. Those kind of opportunities just don't come up every day. I hope that they think about the breadth of opportunity and then the depth. Your imagination can come into play here and you can really carve and create your own path.
I am a huge reader. What book or books have made a very large impact on you personally or professionally?
I am a student of leadership and there have been so many great books, but one that I truly, truly loved because I believe as women in this field of cryptography and cyber, we stand on the shoulders of the greats before us. And one about Elizabeth Smith Friedman, it's called The Woman Who Smashed Codes. And it really is a true story of her love life with William, spies that she worked with. And just, she really was an unlikely heroine who really outwitted a lot of our enemies, World War I and leading into World War II. The other one I'd mentioned that I really, really like, and mostly for funds, but also inspiration, is about the first CIA female operative. I think she was the first. It's called The Wolves at the Door, and it's by Judith Pearson. Her name is Virginia Hall. And she was an amazing.
She's from Baltimore.
Yes.
She's from Baltimore. My daughter's going to go to the school she went to.
How did you know that?
Well, we were reading the book. I have a book club. We were reading the book. And she also had her foot was shot. It was amputated. And I was looking up notable alumni, right? I want to make sure my daughter went to the right school and that she would be challenged and be courageous. And so that woman was a notable alumni of the school, Virginia.
Wow, that's awesome.
Well, I appreciate you taking extra time with me today. And it's been such a pleasure. I hope you enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Thank you. This is awesome. I really appreciate it. It was fun. Really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.